Is Able, the radio show about possibility, where we look at what a person with disabilities can do rather than what they cannot do. Hello, this is Dr. Steve Nurse, and this is one more interview in our series on the Vietnam War. Just a couple comments here from me. It just, you know, I've interviewed quite a few people. I've seen quite a few pictures. One of the things, and I graduated in 1966, and Alan Aronica is my interviewee, and Alan and I were both in high school together, took different paths. But the one thing that I've seen about, with all the pictures and everything that I've seen in Vietnam, it almost just kind of looks like a great big hand came out of the sky and said, here, I'm going to take this group of high school students and we're going to give them some training and put them in a plane and throw them in Vietnam in a war where they've never been before. You know, and that's was kind of like what it was in Kittitas Valley. It was a pretty idyllic existence. You know, we hunted and we fished and we went to high school and we farmed and that was it. And Alan, what do you think about that? Did I describe Kittitas Valley fairly well?
Yeah, you got Kittitas Valley. We were pretty much, that's what we did. Most of us grew up on farms and we did farm work and we hunted and fished because it was the ideal location for it to be able to do that. In my case, being a tribal member, I did a lot of hunting and fishing. That's what we lived on was salmon and deer and elk meat.
And that's interesting, too, because, you know, we hear all this stuff about guns and everything going on today, but where we were in Kittitas Valley, my dad made me take a gun safety course when I was 12 years old. I knew how to shoot a gun. I knew how to pass a gun across the fence. And Alan is right in saying that we grew up with that. We even when I was in college, we would go out and hunt pheasants and chuckers and clean them and bring them back and have dinner. I dated a girl with a family with 12 kids. They relied on an elk and deer every year. So, yeah, and I think that's also, as Alan mentioned, he's in the Yakima tribe. Alan is Native American, indigenous. So what am I supposed to say, Alan, indigenous or Native American? Or
I don't know that, you know, to be politically correct anymore, I'm not sure what we was called. I mean, over the years, we've been called a lot of things, so I'm not sure what's politically correct anymore, but I guess Native American,
yeah.
I like that, indigenous. But
how about First Nation? Yeah. First Nations, maybe. Well, you know, yeah. And I think we're old enough that we're probably, you and I are probably not very politically correct anyhow. And I'm sure, especially the names we used in high school, were not very politically correct. But, you know, that reminds me, too, of I used to go, you probably didn't even know this, but I used to go hunting with Kenny Walker, who was another Native American guy. And he taught me how to clean animals that I didn't think I'd ever eat. So,
we nicknamed him Mud. He wasn't Kenny to most of us. We knew him by Mud. Mud and I, we grew up together and hunted and fished together. We got drafted together in 1966. We went through basic training together. Once we finished basic training, though, we got split up. He went to Fort Ord, California, and I went to Fort Polk, Louisiana.
Yeah. And we used to, our nickname for him when he'd take us out, we used to always call him the Hawk Eater. So that was his other nickname. Well, tell me, Alan, you know, you went to, you did your training and then you got ready to go and you got on a plane and you wound up in Vietnam. What was your first recollection of landing in Vietnam?
Well, our first recollection of landing in Vietnam was we came in when the plane, our plane went to landed, we went over in a C-131, and when we came into Tansanoot Air Base there and stuff, it was under attack. It was still, all I know is that the closer we got to Vietnam, the hotter it got, because they shipped us out of Fort Ord khakis, and we made it to Alaska. We went up through Alaska, and it was colder than heck. We was wrapped up in blankets, but the closer we got to Vietnam, the hotter it got. When we got ready to land, all I know is that they kicked the door open. They told us that somebody was going to be out there, that they were under attack, and we were supposed to run. And all I know is when the door opened up, the heat hit me. I could hardly breathe, and the guy behind me just shoved me out the door, and you hit the ground, and he was running, but we didn't know where we was running to. We just started following. Somebody was shouting and said, "Follow us," and so we followed blindly, not sure what we was getting into.
That's not a very very good way of welcoming someone to a new country, I wouldn't think. And one of the other guys said, he said when he landed in Vietnam, he said you could chew the air.
Yeah, you could. It was unbelievable. The heat and stuff, it took me by surprise, and I thought I was fairly good shape, but that intense heat really got me. And then they put us in an area. We was there for about a week and a half just to get acclimatized in Bearcat. That's where I ended up at.
And that was a place, or that was with a group? That was a
Bearcat was a place that they were just establishing. It's where the 9th Infantry Division was at. I ended up with the 9th Infantry Division as opposed to the 1st Cav. My orders were for the 1st Cav, but they got changed en route because 9th Infantry Division had during a Tet offensive, they lost a lot of soldiers, and so we wound up as replacements for all of those guys that didn't make it.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned you had, and in the stuff you filled out for me, you had one little good luck charm you carried with you, and what was that?
Well, I don't know if it was a good luck or not.
I'm wondering that, too, if with all the things you told me about that you did, I guess good luck is just a term.
There's no such thing as good luck, I don't think. I think we all got a guardian angel, and we better thank him. It made me aware. Yeah, Mud Walker gave me a St. Christopher medal, and the other thing he gave me that was really surprising is he sent me a Bible while I was there, because he says he was stationed in Germany and I was in Vietnam, and he had a Bible sent to me and stuff, and he says, "Hey, you need this more than I do," so he sent me a Bible, and I appreciated it later, or as I went on in life. The old saying, you know, there's no atheist in a foxhole, so I kind of come to believe that.
yeah. I think that's true. And so then you you were at this, was this a landing zone, this Bearcat kind of, or was it a...
Well, Bearcat turned out it was a big area, staging area and stuff for the 9th Infantry Division, and they just brought people in. And when I first got there, it was kind of, they were just working on it, and they were just clearing out. It was like a big clearing in the jungle, just out of Saigon there a ways, in between Saigon and Dillon. By the time I left, it was huge. They had big airplanes coming in there, and of course, they had an area cleared out there where all of the big officers and stuff had mobile homes brought in there and set up, and they'd stay there when they come in country inside the compound. But I was out in a little village called Rakhine, so I only went into Bearcat two times, when I landed, when I was taken down there, and then when I got wounded the first time I was taken there in order to get back to my line outfit.
Uh-huh. You mean to tell me you weren't provided with an air-conditioned trailer when you were out in the field?
Oh, no. We spent our whole time just going from one rice paddy to another one. And what we did back in our outfit did was they just called them, that time they were calling them search and destroy type thing. Our main job or objective was to try and make contact with the enemy somehow, and they just pick you up, fly out there, drop you off, and say, there they are, and you'd stay in contact with them until they disappeared, and then you'd march back to where you're dealing, they'd pick you up and fly you somewhere else. And most of the time, it was always in the same, a week later, we'd be in one area, and the following week, we'd be right back. And it was just like a big circle.
Did you make contact most of the time when you went out?
Sometimes. It depends on the intelligence they got. A couple times, boy, we geared up. They said we was right there at last, that we was going to, there was supposed to be this big NRVA soldiers and all this stuff, and they geared us up, and they loaded us up, and twice as much ammo and all that stuff, and flew us out there and dropped us off, and we was expecting a heck of a fight, and we wasn't sure what to expect. When we jumped off, got there, and we started walking, it turned out it was a herd of water buffalo.
Oh, jeez.
That was quite an experience. We had one guy in there, he earned the nickname Buffalo Rider, because those water buffalo over there, as long as you faced them and didn't turn your back on them, they'd just stand there and stare at you, and you kind of stared them down. But this one soldier in our outfit, he walked on past him, turned his back to him, and next thing you know, that old buffalo was charging at him, and somehow it hooked him and threw him up in the air, and when he come down, he was on the back of the buffalo, and we was all going, but we called him Buffalo Rider after that.
I like that. Well, so it was kind of hit or miss, and I know that they did set out, my other friend talked about setting out, they would set out kind of like little microphones or something, and they would pick up footsteps. So in that case, they probably picked up the footsteps of the water buffalo, right? And that's the...
Well, I don't know how they got their intelligence. All I know is that we got where they told us when they briefed us that the intelligence was saying it was a good-sized force, and we were supposed to make contact with them, and they working with some other deals. We were supposed to be a driving force and push them towards a certain area, and there was another force coming from the other direction. But when we got there, it turned out it was just a large herd of water buffalo.
Wow. Well, tell me about the time that a couple of stories I want you to relate to me about. One is the time that you got injured the first time.
Well, I'd been there just about 6 months when we went on an operation, and of course we always knew where we was going to get in trouble with down there in the Delta. It was always right along the main river, along the Mekong Delta and stuff. It seemed like the VC and stuff, there was all kinds of tunnels that they had in there that they built when they fought the French and stuff, and so they'd always ambush us along those rivers, and then they had a way out. I mean, we'd get them, and then they'd get to a certain point, and it was like they'd disappear, and they'd just go into their tunnels and stuff. And we was on that one operation, and we started taking fire, and everybody was running, and it happened to be there was a couple large ponds on each side of the dikes, because normally we walked out in the rice paddy, but those two particular paddies were so deep we had to go down a dike, and they had that dike booby trap. But I was one of the last guys coming off, and somehow I had a fish leader get caught in the lugs of my boot, and it was hooked to a grenade, and the grenade, I pulled the pin out with that fish leader being caught in my bottom of my boot, and it exploded. But fortunate enough, once again, my guardian angel was looking at me. I was already falling to the ground, and I missed the main force of the blast. I caught some shrapnel, but I didn't catch it all, because if I'd have been upright, I probably wouldn't be here talking to you today.
You know, I've heard that when those things happen, they happen so automatically, you don't think about pain or you don't think about anything. Was that the case? I mean, did you...
Well, in this case, we were being shot at, and we was laying, everybody was running ahead, and of course, we provided cover for the guys that were going up first, and I happened to be the guy bringing up the rear, and and you wasn't sticking around. You just ran off the end of the dike into that next rice paddy, and I got out there maybe 10, 15 feet from it when that grenade went off. But like I said, I was fortunate enough. I was falling to the ground. I'd evidently stepped in some kind of hole that caused me to start falling, and that's the only thing that saved me.
Uh-huh. Wow, that's... What was your feeling at that time? Were you kind of surprised? Yeah. Were you scared? Were you...
Well, my first feeling was is I was numb from the waist down. I couldn't feel my legs, and I was laying there I turned over on my back. I rolled over on my back, so I was looking up, but I was afraid. I started feeling because I didn't feel like I had any legs, and I was afraid I'd lost my leg or something because I couldn't feel nothing. And so when I found it, or just, you know, I just looked, I really did thought I had lost a leg, but fortunate enough, I didn't. I just had shrapnel and stuff, but I've lost the feeling in my left leg over time with the shrapnel because I still have some, it pinched some nerves and stuff.
Uh-huh. And then you went back to Bearcat, and that's where they kind of fixed you up, or?
Well, they sent me to, it was Tontanut Air Base. They had a field hospital there, and they put me in the field hospital. Because it was a field hospital, they said, well, you got a deal. They just sewed me back up, patched me up, kept me there for about a week and a half, and then said, well, we're sending you back to your unit. And so they sent me to Bearcat, and then I had to go from Bearcat back down to the village.
Wow. That's were you a little apprehensive going back down there?
No, I was fine with it. The biggest problem was is I couldn't go to the field for a while since I had open wounds. The biggest thing over there was fighting infection. You had to keep it from just the air and being around the rice paddies and stuff was keeping things from getting infected. So once it healed up and stuff, they sent me back out in the field. So
yeah, and you know, one of the things we wanted to talk about, not to be political, but you know, was, you know, you and I have talked about, you know, this is a war that should have been fought with the military rather than politicians. And tell me about the story when you were when you were observing on the Mekong.
Well, one of the missions we had was around Thanksgiving time. I don't know whether it's politicians or who decide, they decide to have a truce. I think it was for Tet New Year or something coming up. But the one thing that most of us noticed when we was out in the field and stuff is when they called that truce, is all of a sudden we seen a lot of boats going up down the Mekong, going up and down, and they'd deal, and we knew something was going on, and we kept telling them that we need to start stopping some of them. And of course, our orders were not to stop anybody, but just sit back and observe. And we did that for a couple of days, and in my squad, we was out there. We had one guy. Turned out I ended up as a squad leader because our squad leader got wounded and was sent home. And one of the guys, he was down there, and he was from California, and interesting guy, and he knew quite a bit about boats and stuff. And more.
Is he the guy that was? Is he the guy that was from the Hells Angels?
Yeah, he always carried. The reason he was interesting, he always carried a little bag around with him, and we always wondered what was in it. And all of a sudden, one day we talked him in to open it up and let us see, and he had his leather. His Hell's Angel leather pants and leather jacket and stuff been in there, and he carried it with him wherever he went. And he was a machine gunner. He had an M60 machine gun, but he was watching this one sandpan or these sandpans coming up, and these boats were really they had wood piled on them, and it looked like they were just transporting some wood. But he come to me and said, "Look at that boat." And I said, "Well, what's wrong with that boat?" He says, "Well, that wood that's on there, it shouldn't, look at the water line." And he says, "Boy, that boat's riding really low in the water." He says, they were probably 20 feet off of the bank of the Mekong, and he says, I'm going to run down there and stop. I said, well, you know what our orders are. We ain't supposed to. He says, oh, we'll just stop them. He says, they won't know we stopped them. So he goes down there and starts hollering at them, but they, boy, the minute he started hollering, we come out, they started headed for the other
what
side.
Did
the
so what did he holler? What did
he holler? He was saying, Laude, Laude, which meant come here, you know, and they turned and went the other way. So he decided just to deal, and he let a burst of gunfire out with his M60, and pretty soon here, well, about that time, once they heard, and somewhere off in the distance, our commanding officer was sitting close to a helicopter, and he jumped in the helicopter and flew up there and was wondering what was going on, and he landed out there, come running down there and yelling at us and telling us he was going to court-martial all of us, but it turned out we had people jumping overboard and all that stuff, and when we got the boat, we caught the commanding officer or the payroll officer for the Viet Cong and a whole bunch of papers, and then we found these boats were all full of mortar rounds and mortar tubes and all kinds of stuff. And once we did that, the guy said, okay, from then on our orders changed. Sink all the boats going up and down the river. I mean, that's the kind of thing that would happen, you know. And we knew it was going on, but they'd already had 2 weeks of transporting Dylan. Wasn't right after they lifted the deal, then we got pounded.
Did you find any other boats after that that were transporting?
Well, no, pretty much most of the boats then, once we got the orders to they put a deal out, they just started, the gunships and the boat patrols, they started taking care of the boats, and they quit running up and down then. But they had 2 weeks of truce time where we just sat there and watched them as they moved all this. So as they replenished their supply, you know.
I think it was somebody that was one of my other interviewers, when I talked to him on the phone, they were saying that, you know, one thing the Viet Cong could do was move a tremendous amount of material in a short period of time with tons and tons of people. And even if you interrupted the supply line, even if you killed 25 guys that were carrying mortars, you know, there were 100 in front of them, 100 behind them carrying the same thing, you know?
Oh, yeah, they could move material around. You know, those people, the one thing I found out about the Viet Cong and stuff is you have to admire them. I had to admire them as a people and stuff. You know, we underestimated those people, and our leaders did anyway, and I think our commanders did. They just did not understand who they were fighting, and they thought they were just going to. But they were fighting for their cause. We thought we had a cause, but those people had a cause, I think. And they were fighting for that. And it kind of reminded me of our people. You know, I always felt that the Vietnamese people were caught between a rock and a hard place. Kind of like the American Indian was. He was out, their people from the North Viet Cong and stuff, if they didn't participate, they'd kill them, and then the Americans would come in and say, we're going to save you, and a few of them would get killed on our side. So if the North Vietnamese were down there, you had to go along with them, or they were going to kill you, and then if the Americans showed up, you had to be on their side. So you was kind of danged if you do and danged if you don't, and I could see that, because that's kind of where your American Indians at.
Yeah,
caught between a rock and a hard place. And when you got to know the people, they just like all the rest of us. They were human beings, just tried to exist, and they were caught between these two forces that were fighting for something else. You know, most of the regular Vietnamese people were just humble people trying to make a living in a rice paddy. You know.
You know, I heard this statement one time that. You know, one of my friends said that when he was over there, and I think he did a lot of the same type of thing that you did, you know, that was the working with the village and helping them and kind of the pacification of the people. But he said, you know, they didn't care about politics. They didn't care if they were a democracy. They didn't care if they were communist. He said all they worried about was where they were going to get their next bowl of rice for the next meal.
That's right. Of course, we disrupted their whole system, messed it up, because once you brought, of course, they had Vietnamese money thing. We used piastres and stuff, but they didn't take them long. You had to, they wanted the American currency as opposed to the piastre because of war. But whenever the military decided to make a currency change on our funny money, what we call funny money, we always knew ahead of time because the villagers and stuff had come to us and they'd want their Vietnamese money back. So we knew we was getting ready for a currency change on our what we call funny money because they did that periodically and whatnot. So that if you had any of our funny money, that funny money after once they made the change, it was no longer any good.
Yeah.
So the Vietnamese would come. They'd bring all their, they'd want all their piastres back, and they'd give us all our funny money back.
Oh, gee. Well, so, and the second time you were wounded by a booby trap too, correct?
Yeah, well, actually, it was a booby trap, but it's another one of those cases. I'm not sure why I'm alive. The day that they dropped us off in this area, there was six of us that got wounded all about the same time. One of the guys that I was with, the first one got that was a landmine. We got in this area and we'd been in that area the week before. And that week before, that area was all cleared out. And when they brought us in a week later, there was just booby traps all over because when we first got out of the helicopters, one of our men jumped out, and he landed right on a booby trap, and it took both his legs off. And he had just gotten back in the field from previously being wounded. He'd been out for a while. He was reluctant to go back, and he got wounded. He went back to the state. They shipped him straight to the state. And then we went on, and it turned out we went to this. There was this big moat around this hooch was there, and I walked around the end of it, and I noticed that all this ground was kind of worked up, and I was standing next to this building, and they wanted me to go inside and search this hooch out, but when I started to go in there, it was the weirdest thing, Steve. I don't know, most people will probably say I'm crazy, but when I started to walk in through that hooch, it was like somebody put a hand in my chest and said, if you walk in there, you ain't coming back out. So I stopped and hesitated, and I decided not to go in there. And one of my other buddies said, don't go in there, just throw a trip flare on it and then stand back. So I did that. I threw a trip flare on it and set it on fire and backed up. And so, because it was burning pretty hot, and all of a sudden when I was standing there, I'd apparently stepped on a landmine, and I didn't know it. And when I picked up my foot to walk off, that mine blew up. And I don't know why it didn't kill me or deal. It just threw me about 100 feet up in the air, I think. And I went deal, and when I come back down, I was on my back, and we had three other guys that got wounded from the blast, and one of the guys was a friend of mine from Yakima. He caught a piece of shrapnel in his neck, and I wound up holding the IV and stuff as we got shipped or taken out of there. And as we left, the guys told me later that hooch, when it all of a sudden it blew up, and it blew up. Hole in around big enough to put two or three deuce and a half in. I guess they had all kinds of explosives in there, and that's why all the booby traps.
Wow.
They had that area booby trapped, and I never got to see the hole and stuff because they dusted me off, and along with the guy from Yakima and a couple others. There, like I said, there were six of us wounded that day, and that only left, there was only 12 of us to start with. So
wow.
All the rest going, so we lost pretty much half of the platoon right there.
Wow. Well, I hate to,
but
go ahead. I hate to leave on that note, but
yeah, well, I feel blessed. I had a guardian angel, and boy, I every day I think about that, and it it made me a believer. I think that's what made a believer out of me if I wasn't one before.
Well, that's good. And lunch on me in Ellensburg. Let's have a beer and let's kind of salute all those guys that didn't make it back. You know, those are the heroes.
My salute goes out to all my fellow comrades and stuff, and welcome home to all of them. And thank you for your service.
Yeah, thank you, Alan. Love you. Love you, brother. Love you, 66er. Have a good one, and we'll talk to you soon. Thank you. That was Alan Aronica.
To stream this or any other episode of Is Abled with Dr. Stephen W. Nurse, go to voiceofashon.org and look under the Shows tab.